Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. And we're going to be looking at adventures from the pump to the pipeline. We're going to be talking with Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, California. She's the author of Oil on the Brain. It's published by Nan A. Talese Doubleday. She's currently an Irvine Fellow at the New American Foundation in Oakland. You know, obsessions with oil are hard to shake. The title of this book comes from a song about the oil fever that gripped the country after oil was drilled out of a well in Pennsylvania in 1859. People rushed to towns with names like Pit Hole and Oil City, hoping to find their fortune in crude. In this book, Lisa writes about the culture of oil, the economies, the destinies, and dreams shared by people who live along the world's pipelines. She says she hoped to make sense of the larger universe of oil. And we will be talking with her in just a moment, as soon as we connect with her in California. She starts her narrative at her local gas station, which is Twin Peaks Petroleum in San Francisco, where a regular unleaded in the summer of 03 was $1.619. You know, gas stations are collections of incidental items, impulses, and routines that seem in themselves to be inconsequential but aggregate into a giant economy when multiplied by the hungers of 194 million licensed American drivers. We have her on the phone, and so it's a pleasure to talk with Lisa Marganelli in Oakland, California. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I am great, and I must tell you, this has just been a super book. I've learned more about the oil business than I ever knew.
Wow, that's great to hear.
This book very well has its roots in the spring of 2001, as you mentioned, when you reported on Saddam Hussein's 64th birthday party, one of the few people I know who had a chance to attend that party.
Yeah, the problem was Saddam never showed up to those things, so he was afraid of being assassinated, so they sent people who looked like Saddam would sort of crop up all over Baghdad and Tikrit on that day, but not Saddam himself.
Not himself. And then shortly after, you found yourself headed to a delightful place called Arctic Village, Alaska, where you found people who were fighting oil drilling in the Anwar.
Yes. This was a group of about 125. It was a Native American group, a village, about 125 people, and they lived, you know, it was a plane ride into there and a plane ride out, and people had lived a subsistence lifestyle for a really long time. Their life was, and a lot of their religion was based on the caribou, and they were trying to prevent drilling in Anwar because it would disrupt the caribou calving grounds. The place where the caribous would have their calves.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what happened as you got there and got to Alaska? What sort of prompted this dream of a book or germ
well,
of a book?
Basically, in flying into Arctic Village, I was looking down the whole time at the Alaska pipeline, which is really a huge structure that goes across the starts way up in the north of Alaska on the Beaufort Sea, and comes all the way down through Alaska, this giant straw. Basically, it just looks like an enormous straw, and it just struck me that we were literally sucking oil from the furthest ends of the earth, places we can't even imagine, just so I could drive back and forth to the mall down here in Oakland. And I just thought, boy, it would be interesting to see how my end of the pipeline connects to this other end of the pipeline. And so basically that's what started the whole trip. And then there's another thing too, which is that, you know, I'm a reporter, and part of what I love to do is to get into places that are off limits and places that produce oil and refine oil and store oil are some of the most off limits places on earth, even though we're very intimately connected to them. So it was kind of a challenge to figure out how to get into these different places. And that's That was another motivator for me.
Right. You also write about being in the Prudhoe Bay oil field, and you're observing an experiment on cleaning oil spills and water sponsored by the U.S. Minerals Management Service. Mm. And it was there that you began to see what the allure was for people who were close to crude.
Right. Well, when you what I was watching them do, the scientists were actually studying how to clean up an oil spill in very icy conditions. So when you've got ice floating on water, you can't send people out in a boat to pick up the spilled oil because the people in the boat will get crushed. So one thing that they were experimenting with was lighting the oil on fire because, you know, it's kind of like a tea light, basically, floating on top of the water. You can light it on fire. You have to throw napalm on it to get it to light.
Uh-huh.
Or they also have these helicopters that have things called helitorches. I unfortunately never got to see a helitorch at work, or fortunately, I guess.
But
they were lighting oil spills on fire, and what I had never realized was just what crude oil looks like. I mean, crude oil is this stunning stew of molecules that range in length from one carbon atom to, like, hundreds of carbons. And they all have hydrogen bonds around them, and those are what give the energy when oil burns. So you see right in front of you this sort of symphony of burning as the small light molecules burn first, and then it gets down, they heat up the heavier, thicker molecules, and then each of those kind of burst into flame. And it's quite an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's sort of symphonic. It's very charismatic. Suddenly you understand exactly why there have been so many wars fought over oil. I mean, it's just this stunning, fascinating substance that's so incredibly useful that it's hard to really think about it in the day-to-day.
Our guest is Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, the author of Oil on the Brain. It's published by Doubleday, currently an Irvine Fellow at the New American Foundation. You can follow along, get more about the book when you go to oilonthebrain.com, which is Lisa's website. And as I say, it's just a really fascinating book. You start your story by going to your local gas station, Twin Peaks Petroleum, in San Francisco in the summer of 2003, and there we get to meet BJ the manager as the first character in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, BJ, when I first met BJ, he's a tall man. He was from India. He had a heavy accent. He didn't speak very much, and he appeared to actually be sleeping, which, as you know, not sleeping, but sort of sleep standing. He didn't really seem to interact very much with people in the station. His eyes were sort of droopy, and he reminded me of a lot of the way that I perceived convenience store clerks to be kind of not totally there. But it turned out that he was actually incredibly aware of everything that was going on around the station, because people are constantly trying to scam in gas stations and convenience stores. And in fact, the first morning that I was there, a van pulled up into the station, and a man got out, and he started to walk away. And suddenly, BJ came to life and just bounced out from behind his counter and out of the gas station and confronted the man. And there was some sort of yelling, and then the man got back in his car and drove away. And it turned out the man was trying to abandon his van in the gas station lot to take the bus, which just blew me away. And it's just the beginning of the sort of scams that people pull in gas stations. They perceive them as a no man's land or as a place that owes them something, because we as consumers are very resentful about the amount of money that we pay for gas.
You document this too, that we pick up these straw men, so to speak, and use them as targets of our dissatisfaction with rising prices of oil.
Absolutely, yeah. We have confrontations in gas stations where we yell at the gas station owners. We yell at the truck drivers. Truck drivers, when prices are there was a pipeline break in Arizona a few years ago, and prices went very, very high because it was scarce. The gasoline was scarce, and the governor had to order police escorts for tanker trucks delivering gas because people would try to attack them. And of course, the guys who drive the gas trucks, they're making, I don't know, maybe $13 an hour or something like that. Not a lot. They're not the beneficiaries of all of our money. And the guys who run the gas stations are in many cases right now making around 5 cents a gallon profit, which is pretty small when you think about how dangerous gas is and how much it has to be controlled and how volatile the price is and how, you know, gas station owners are constantly buying gasoline on the spot market, and then so they buy in the wholesale market and they sell in the retail market, and they're constantly kind of balancing all of these different markets and different realities.
In the book, people will find how the price of gasoline breaks down, including its crude price, its refining price, the various pricing that goes on in there. But yesterday, if I'm right, a barrel of oil hit a record $80.
Yeah. I guess on reports of the storm that was headed up in the Gulf of Mexico.
When you started this book, what was the per barrel price of oil then? Do you have any idea?
I think it was around, it was between $20 and $30 a barrel, and then it kind of went up to $40. And then over the past couple of years, it's gotten up towards, you know, $75. It went up, $40 was a big barrier, $50 was a big barrier. And then it went up towards 75 again, and now we've gone through the $80 barrel barrier, which is pretty...
Somebody's making a lot of money here.
Yeah, they sure are. They sure are. But, you know, oil is a pretty precious resource. You know, I'm not sure that it serves any of our... When oil was $9 a barrel, which was in 1998, that also wasn't a particularly fair price for oil.
No.
So, but the people who make the most money at this point are the people who actually own the reserves, and that would be the governments of countries with big oil reserves, because most of the oil reserves now are owned by governments. So the government of Venezuela, the government of Saudi Arabia, the government of Russia, they make the big profits at this point.
Lisa,
and, of course, the oil companies make big profits.
Yes. Lisa Marganelli is our guest. A caller said that it was his understanding that 80% of the pipeline oil from Alaska goes to Japan and not to North America. You have any idea whether that's valid?
Oh, you know, when the pipeline was first built, there was a law passed that because the U.S. taxpayers had helped pay for the pipeline, that all the oil actually had to come to the United States. And it did something very interesting on the west coast of the U.S., which is that it actually made oil prices and gas prices depressed because there was sort of too much oil. Now that there's a lot less coming out of the pipeline, they changed those laws and that oil can be exported. I'm not aware that it's going to Japan. Many refineries on the West Coast were configured specifically for Alaska North Slope oil. What's happened over the past 10 years is that that like very light, good Alaska-type oil has become much more scarce in the market. So it's about $15 more per barrel than the cheaper kind of more sulfuric, saltier oils that are coming out of the Middle East. And as a result, West Coast refineries are reconfiguring themselves to process the cheaper oils from elsewhere, so something from Venezuela or something from Ecuador or something from the Middle East, and so that they can, BP or ConocoPhillips, the companies that own that oil that's coming through the Alaska pipeline, can sell that at a premium to refineries that aren't reconfigured to deal with the heavy
oil. Lisa, I've got to break in. We're going to pause for the news. You stay with us. We'll come back and we'll take more calls about adventures from the pump to the pipeline. It's 12 o'clock and I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pleased to have you along with us today as we talk with Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, California. She's an Irvine Fellow at the New American Foundation and the author of Oil on the Brain, which is published by Doubleday. Barbara Ehrenreich says of Oil on the Brain could be called the petro-economy for dummies, especially hardcore dummies like me who insist on being entertained as well as educated. From the corner gas station to the oil fields of Nigeria, there couldn't be a better traveling companion than Marganelli. She's fast, fearless, funny, and a brilliant observer. Mary Roach says very few people are smart enough to tackle a subject as complicated as world oil, and of those people, I would wager that not one of them could do it with the humor and crackle and delight that Marganelli brings to bear. We'll talk more with Lisa Marganelli. Take your calls after the news from National Public Radio in Washington. Good afternoon. Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about Oil on the Brain. That's the name of a book by Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, California. And we're pleased that she's spending time with us today to talk about this book. Lisa, again, thank you for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you for talking with me.
Americans consume 10,000 gallons of gas a second, 3 gallons per person per day. Where does the oil come from? Where is it taking us? That's the thrust of this book. In 2003, when gas was selling for less than $2 a gallon in the United States, Lisa started hanging out along the oil supply chain, spent time in a gas station, with truckers, in a refinery, on a drilling rig, at the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the New York Mercantile Exchange, where millions of paper barrels of oil are traded every day. She went to visit the oil exporting countries, including our first partner, Venezuela, Chad, Iran, Nigeria. And by the time she was done, she had quite a book here. And again, congratulations on this.
Oh, thanks.
You must be very pleased with this.
Well, to tell you the truth, it was about 4 years of my life, and it was an incredible adventure. I'm really happy to see that it reached people and it made them, it helped them to think about oil in a different way. But for me, sometimes I look at it and think, what on earth is in that book? It's just 4 years. So, for me, it was a big adventure.
Well, you start off by going to your local Twin Peaks Petroleum there, but then you talk about gasoline stations as this collections of incidental items, impulses, and routines that add up to a staggering amount of business. Talk about that side of the petroleum business.
Well, when I go to the gas station, I spend maybe 2.5 minutes there filling my tank. That's the average amount of time that people spend there. And we might run in, and I might be feeling, you know, a little bit hungry or something. I run in and grab a bag of corn nuts. But those impulse buys that we make in the gas stations are actually what keep them afloat. They survive by selling us corn nuts and water and fountain drinks. And those are billion-dollar businesses in addition to the amount that we spend on gasoline. I mean, to give you an idea of how huge this tiny incidental, these little decisions that we make are, you've probably noticed that on every single gasoline sign, it says that the price is $2.85 and 0.9 cents. Well, that 0.9 cents, which is on every single gas sign in the country, if you find one, let me know, write to me,
okay.
That doesn't have that sign. That 0.9 cents, when you add it up, equals $1.6 billion a year. And it's kind of, the gas station owners call it the invisible penny. It's the penny that people don't take it into account, and gas stations themselves are trying to make as much money as possible and to keep themselves afloat, so they sort of hide that extra penny in the 0.9 cents. I think that's hilarious, $1.6 million in hidden pennies.
Also, the owner of that gas station, Michael Garib?
Garib, yes.
Garib says, I make more money selling water than gas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And water doesn't explode. It doesn't leach into the groundwater. Or if it does, it doesn't make any difference. They make more money on the water. They make more money on sunglasses. You might have wondered why there are sunglasses in every convenience store and why oftentimes they're covered with dust. It's because the markup is 100% or more, whereas the markup on gasoline is, as I said, around 5 cents a gallon, which is very little when you consider that the gallon now is close to $3.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Nancy in Grafton. Nancy, hi. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, up in Canada, they are cleaning sand and getting oil out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are building a big pipeline coming down through Wisconsin. And there's a heck of a lot of jobs out there on this pipeline that they're putting through the state. And I wonder what she has to say about that. Thank you.
Well, on the one hand, Canada is one of the U.S.'s biggest oil suppliers, and it's important to keep that oil flowing for us until we come up with our Plan B, which which would be to use a lot less oil and start switching to some renewables. On the other hand, tar sands and oil sands are very, very energy intensive. I mean, you have to put an enormous amount of energy into heating up those sands to get the oil off and then refining that oil to something usable. They are very destructive in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases that they release. And, you know, I personally think that we need to start paying for greenhouse gas and how much we use and how much we release, how much we emit. And when that happens, that oil from Canada that's coming from the tar sands is going to look quite expensive.
Nancy? Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, 263-1890. Otherwise, it's 800-642-1234 as we talk about adventures from the pump to the pipeline with Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, California. You talk to a number of people. You ride with a trucker, Roger, and he tells you his story, the things that he's concerned about trying to do his job, the difficulties that his dispatcher has, because this business of shipping oil from place to place is extremely complicated.
It is. It certainly is. I mean, even the way they load the trucks that you see on the highway every day. Those gasoline trucks have different compartments in them, and they have to load them so they're balanced, so that they, are as stable as possible going down the freeway. You can actually feel the gas sloshing in them when you stop. One of the big issues for us as consumers in the U.S. is that over the past 10 or 15 years, we've used more and more gasoline every year. We increase our gasoline consumption by about 1.7%. We do that for perfectly reasonable reasons. Our houses are further from where we work. We have to commute longer, and because we're commuting longer, we buy bigger cars so we feel more safe. And all of these things, the longer commutes, the bigger cars, the desire for safety, comfort, all these things have contributed to us using a lot more gasoline than we did 15 years ago per person and as a society. But the thing is that our pipeline system is really close to being full of and is really stretched. So we have more and more tankers on the road, and that means in some senses, I mean, the tanker drivers are very careful, but every time you put another tanker on the road, you're essentially rolling the dice of an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So, in our search for safety in our bigger cars and our further out houses and things like that, we also have taken on new risks with gasoline, and those are showing up as high prices. But they're also showing up in things like, you know, a tanker overturned near my house in Oakland, actually, and melted the freeway a few months ago. And that was kind of stunning to everyone, that a single tanker could actually collapse two layers of freeway.
Yeah, scorched it.
Yeah, and, a tanker, gasoline actually has, in addition to being flammable, it also has sort of an explosive component, and it's pound for pound, it has more energy in it than TNT. I mean, TNT is effective as an explosive because it burns so quickly that it's a huge boom.
Mm-hmm.
But gasoline actually has more energy in it than TNT. It's just that it takes longer to light. So you know, every tanker that drives by you on the freeway is it's not an accident waiting to happen exactly.
I didn't want to
but
say
it,
that.
It
no.
could.
No, so. but it is a risk out there.
Yeah, it is.
And you just keep adding to it.
Right.
Sarah in Milwaukee, let's give you a chance to get into the conversation. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a question. I recently heard that oil prices or gasoline prices, as it were, are adjusted for wholesale costs for the gas stations for the heat and the cold, because it expands in heat and contracts in cold. But I was just wondering why that price adjustment was not passed on to the consumer.
Wow. I don't know what's happening in Wisconsin. In California, we have a different formulation of gasoline during the summer versus the winter because the gasoline is more of a vapor in the heat. And to cut the smog, we changed the formulation so it's not as vaporous. They changed the sort of structure of the molecules in the gasoline. I actually don't know what's going on in Wisconsin with wholesale prices and adjustments for heat. I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right, Sarah, thank you very much.
If you come to my website, I will try to research that and put something up on the blog.
And again, the website is oilonthebrain.com. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. Sarah, thanks for the call. Sorry we couldn't. We do recognize that there is a difference in formulation, and that probably reflects a difference in price. Let's go to Frank next in Oshkosh. Hello, Frank.
Hello, hello. This is a very good conversation. I'm just curious to know what the author thinks of peak oil and other authors like James Howard Kunstler, who wrote The Long Emergency, and basically stating that what do we do when oil begins to run out and or runs out very quickly, you know, such as all the hot spots we have in Nigeria, the Middle East, etc. And then I didn't ask the person online, but what would be the true cost, or maybe you could guess, because of all the money we have to spend on, you know, to keep our supply secure, does that ever get added into the total cost per gallon or per barrel?
All right, good question. So I'm going to answer the first one. No, we don't add all of the hidden costs of oil into the price of gasoline, but we should. And, you know, the estimates range from a dollar a barrel for extra costs for, you know, protecting the pipelines and that sort of thing, up above $5, not a barrel, $5 a gallon. So I think that we could assume that those prices are pretty high. I would, you know, if you, I don't know where exactly the price per gallon lies, but I would say we have to assume that we really pay a lot more per gallon than we do. We also pay a lot more per gallon just to stockpile oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We pay more in terms of the amount of money that we spend on health care to mitigate the risks of pollution, the effects of air pollution on, say, children's lungs. Children with asthma have you know, high health expenses. We pay all of these things. We pay a lot more, and but I can't tell you an exact number. Just that it's at least what we're already paying for a gallon, and then probably quite a bit more. We also pay a lot because we pay all sorts of subsidies to the oil industry, and we have subsidies that encourage the use of more oil, which by encouraging the use of more oil, we send the price of gasoline higher. And so it's rather hard to extrapolate out just how much it is extra that we're spending on oil than the price at the pump. So that's one question. The second question you had is about peak oil. And what I find interesting about peak oil is, on the one hand, I think that the question of running out of oil is very difficult to answer. We really don't know what's in other countries' reservoirs. We know that Saudi Arabia is not really behaving like a country that's about to run out of oil. If they were about to so-called run out of oil, you would imagine that the price would be well over $100 a barrel. So the question of when we start to get significantly, when we pump out as much of the cheap oil as there is and the oil production starts declining because of what's in the reservoirs, is an open question, I think, but many people have been addressing it recently. But what's more interesting to me is I think we're already in the time of the beginnings of the emergency. We already see the beginnings of oil shortages. We see that our own domestic pipeline infrastructure is stretched to the maximum. Small problems overseas and small problems in our own small weather issues now create huge spikes in oil. A small attack by a militia in Nigeria is going to affect the world oil price. Attacks by Iraqi militias on the pipelines also affect the world oil price. All of these small things have started to have large effects. And I think that this is the beginning of the other story of oil, when the oil is not running plentifully and we start to worry. And some of the worry is just worry, and we pay more money for that worry. And some of the worry is actually probably going to turn into shortages at some point. But we don't know when that is. So I think that the, you know, you talk about when is the day going to come when things are going to change. I think they've already changed. I think we're seeing those changes. And part of that is high prices. And part of it is that we're getting signals now that we need to change. And, you know, to be honest, we're just not making those changes yet, and we need to.
Is that the sort of the lesson that you learned from this book, from writing this book, is that exactly what you just said?
I would say that. I would say one of the lessons, actually, your questions, both of your questions really corresponded to what I learned from the book. The first is that there is no such thing as cheap gas.
That's gone.
And, and the second thing I learned from the book is that I think the future of oil is going to be very, very different from the past. And we really need to think strategically about how we want to use energy and how we can limit the amount of energy we use and how we can interact with our trading partners around the world in a different way. You know, when you look at the human rights abuses associated with oil, it's fairly horrific. And that now is showing up as high prices when militias in Nigeria attack the pipelines. But that's really human rights. It's, you know, we can say that it's an armed group, or we can say anything we want about it, but really what we have is a really sad problem of human rights and poverty in oil-producing countries, and that's starting to affect us at home.
And you pose the question, or I'll rephrase a question that you had, is the only ending to the oil story a frantic and brutal scramble for resources dominated by an increasingly craven, addicted United States?
I would say definitely not. Of course not. We're an incredibly versatile, adaptable economy with the ability to really change our markets, to change our behavior, to change the way we do things, to change our technology. We can do this, but we have to get on the stick. We can't just imagine that that we can wait another 5 years before doing anything.
Frank, thank you so much for your questions. We appreciate hearing from you, and let's move to Bruce in Medford next. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon. Are you familiar with the New York Mercantile Exchange?
Yes.
Why do they get to set the price of oil?
Well, because they're the place that is the interface between the largest consumers in the world with the most money, and that's the U.S., and all the people who want to sell oil. And if you read in the book, there's a whole chapter about the NYMEX. I went and spent a couple of days there watching the trading going on. The other place that sets the London exchange also sets prices, but the two of them kind of work they work in relationship to each other. Basically, every barrel of oil in the world is priced in relationship to the paper barrels that are traded on the NYMEX. But there's a whole sort of historical story of how they came to be ahead of it. Part of it is that the NYMEX used to trade potatoes, and one year in the 70s, the potatoes, which were mostly from Maine, they were trading potato futures. When they were actually delivered to potato buyers, they were not suitable for trading. And so that year, the exchange lost all of its business because it could no longer guarantee that the potatoes that it sold futures for were actually going to arrive. So they had to find another kind of business, and they settled on heating oil, and then gradually that became crude oil.
Thanks very much, Bruce. We appreciate the question because that helped to illuminate another part of this process from the pump to the pipeline. In this book by Lisa Marcanelli, Oil on the Brain. In there, we meet some really fabulous characters. I'm just going to mention one of them, C.D. Roper, who's on a natural gas platform down in Texas. Talk about some of the characters like him that you met along the way.
Well, C.D. had worked all over the oil industry, everywhere from Africa and the Middle East to the far north of Alaska, and he had grown up in the oil industry. His father and grandfather were both in the industry. When he was a little kid, if they were going out to the oil rigs, he would sometimes crawl in the back of the truck and hide. He was very proud of his first hard hat. And he introduced me to kind of the way that he was in some ways an amateur geologist, and he worked on the drilling rig. He introduced me to the way that he thought about underground and the way that oil is and gas are, the way that prospectors look for them and also the way that they drill for them. And what was interesting to me was that for him, thinking about what Texas looked like during the Cretaceous was almost as real as just driving down the road today. I mean, his grandfather had told him a story about when there was a huge red mountain in the middle of the sea where Texas was. The mountain is called the Llano Uplift. And his grandfather had given him this amazing picture as a child of what it would be like to be traveling across Texas heading towards the big red mountain. And then, of course, what happened was that red mountain got scrubbed down by erosion and ends up in one of the sedimentary layers underneath Texas today that the drill bits go through on their way to the oil. And so I guess what was interesting to me about him was the incredible sort of passion that he had for drilling underground, which I'd always thought of as kind of a gross and dirty business. And instead it was this real landscape that used to exist and that could be predicted in some ways underground.
Well, it's a fascinating character and a fascinating story, and we appreciate your being with us to talk about it. I know you've had other media contacts, so the book must be getting a lot of attention right now.
Well, it's been very nice. People have really liked it, and I've gotten a lot of nice letters from people. Yeah.
Well, I learned a lot about how the process works, and I appreciate having that. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Lisa Marganelli of Oakland, California, is the author of Oil on the Brain, published by the Nan A. Talese Doubleday. She's currently an Irvine Fellow at the New American Foundation. When she began this book in the summer of 2003, gas at her local station was $1.619. And when she finished in the summer of 2006, it was $3.219. And Lord knows what it is.